Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips for our weekly chat. This week we're talking about Mrs. May's mounting problems, Armenia, and the possibility of Donald Trump receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. I hope you enjoy listening. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio joining us this evening from London, England, where he is a resident and also, as it turns out, a political hack. And I'll explain that in a moment. I say that with tongue in cheek. But first, Tom, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Lockwood. Always good to be on.
And tell us about the weather.
The weather. It's winter again.
What do you mean it's winter again?
Well, we have brief summer, slipped slightly back to spring, and then winter hit us once again. It fell down to freezing.
Really? Wow.
Yep.
That's surprising. And is this weather normal or, I mean, you know, this kind of gyration?
We have had in the month of April the coldest day for 70 years and the hottest day for 70 years in April.
Mm. Well.
In the space of about 10 days.
Well, it's typical of spring. It's never standard. Well, real quickly, before we move on to other items, what is the issue related to all the flowers in the gardens there in England? Because they have many of them.
Yeah, well, they seem to be surviving. I mean, everything is very green because with the cold weather also comes a lot of rain,
mm-hmm.
Tons and tons of it. And so the garden is thriving, but things are not growing very fast. They're lying dormant, waiting for the sun to come out, and then it just take off.
Well, the sun will be arriving soon, I guarantee. All right, Tom, I want to move on to another item I said at the opening, a political hack. I understand you're engaged in managing a campaign.
Well, it's actually, I'm helping. I'm the membership secretary for the Lib Dems. And my wife is the campaign manager, and she's also standing.
Now, do you not have a problem with nepotism there in the political arena?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay, what is involved in this activity? And by the way, are you allowed to talk about this on radio in light of the fact that though this is being aired in the States, I'm just curious. There are some very interesting nuances to political campaigning there in the United Kingdom.
Oh, yes, we're allowed to talk about it.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to be on radio. Tomorrow night is election, and I'm going to be on local radio as a talking head, and spin doctor giving my assessment of what is happening at the polling stations.
Nothing changes with you. Tom Arms, of course, spin doctor and talking head here on Viewpoints Around the World every Wednesday afternoon. And by the way, just to remind everyone, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded since he is some 5 hours ahead of us. So as this is beginning to air, it's nearly, 11:15 his time there in London. Tom, I want to talk about some events here since we are chatting about politics. First item out of the gate, the Washington Correspondents' Dinner that was conducted this past weekend, the nerd prom, as it's sometimes described. How much coverage did that get? And, of course, the rather colorful speech provided by the comedian, if you want to call her that, Michelle Wolf. What kind of response, what kind of coverage was that given?
Well, you know, she was criticized for being, you know, a bit too close to the bone. It didn't get a great deal of coverage. This has been a very big week for domestic British and European news. And those have grabbed most of the headlines. I think it probably would have received more coverage if that hadn't been the case. So it was covered. It was not covered in a big way.
No, my reason for asking that question related to the supposed comedic routine of Michelle Wolf is that the Brits are renowned for being rather cryptic and, you said, cutting to the bone at times. Is this was there a perception that maybe this did go beyond the veil, if you will?
Yes, I think it went beyond the they felt it went beyond the pale when it came to Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She was, Donald Trump is fair game, but talking about a woman's appearance is another matter.
Very interesting. All right. And moving on to other items here in the States, curious about the coverage. The U.S. Immigration asylum issue there, the caravan that has arrived in San Diego. How much coverage is that getting in?
Not very much coverage at all, but we've got our own big immigration scandal here.
I want to talk about
which
that.
Which could bring down the government, which we'll come to later.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason it didn't get much coverage.
Well, now, amidst all of this, and of course we've talked about this at times, the criticism of the U.S. and its its immigration policies, do they continue to, and nothing's changed there in light of the fact that we are going to be talking?
Oh, nothing's changed.
Okay.
And nothing's changed.
All right, because this is going to apply to another conversation here in a few moments with you, Tom. Tom Arms, of course, with us this afternoon, lookaheadnews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And then, Tom, the other question goes to this topic of the recent visits by Emmanuel Macron, president of France, and Chancellor Angela Merkel from Germany, both of whom were there to, I gather, promote, well, not only good relations, but also to support the U.S. participation with Iran. And we're going to get into further details on that. But how much coverage did those two visits receive there in the European press in the U.K.?
They both got a lot of coverage, especially Macron. Also, the aftermath, Macron said that he did not think that he'd been able to dissuade President Trump from ending American involvement in the Iran nuclear accord. The other thing was, of course, Mrs. Merkel's visit was also focused on the nuclear accord, but I think more focused on the tariffs. And it was noted that, after her visit, the decision on the tariffs being imposed on EU countries has been delayed.
Right. Now, how is that being received again in the European press?
Well, that's being received as good hard work by the German chancellor as a result of her efforts.
Now, the question goes to, of course, leadership within the European Union. And, of course, Angela Merkel has at times given indications that she would like to abdicate that role to someone else. And, of course, we know that Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has shown a great deal of interest in taking over that position. What about the general opinions of those nations, the general populace? Would Germany be willing to let the French take a leading role in the European Union?
I don't think it's quite that simple. They want to work in tandem with the French.
Okay.
And they each have something to offer. The French have a much more effective military force. They have contacts with former French colonies.
Mm-hmm.
They have troops in Africa, which Germany does not have an effective military force. It is, however, more of an economic giant than France is. So France has more political and military strength internationally, whereas Germany has more economic strength. And the idea is, hopefully, that the two would work together.
Now, amidst all of that, and of course the issues, we're going to get to this in a moment on the issue of Iran, is there a feeling that there was any kind of effort afoot to mitigate the U.S. opinion of Iran and the nuclear deal in light of the fact that Israel has exposed definite evidence of Iran's continued interest in developing more nuclear weaponry?
It's very interesting to use the word definite. That's not how it's being described here.
Hmm.
And, they're saying that certainly back in 2003 or whenever it was, that Iran was working towards the development of a nuclear weapon. But the International Atomic Energy Agency says, according to their inspectors, that they have stopped working towards a development of a nuclear weapon. Right. And they haven't been since about 2013, I think, or something like that.
Okay, we're going to get back to this. Real quick question before we go to the break. The issue of Iran, is there concerns related to the recent analysis and disclosures made by the Israeli Mossad?
There are concerns in how it's affecting what Trump is doing.
Okay.
Trump is using it as an excuse to withdraw from the accord. But every single one of the other signatories, the British, the French, the German, the Russians and the Chinese have all said that they don't accept the Israeli arguments and that no agreement is much worse than the agreement they have at the moment.
All right, we're going to bring this up in just a few more moments. I want to take a quick break with our foreign editor, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Coming up in a moment, we are going to talk briefly about the issue of Alfie Evans and how this was played both in the British press, but around the world. Stay with us here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. This portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate Tom's, sleeping schedule. If he gets much sleep in light of the fact that he's involved in a political campaign there in his area of London. But Tom, I want to talk about a topic that has, gained a lot of notoriety now for the United Kingdom, particularly in the community of Liverpool, the topic being the young man Alfie Evans. And there was questions as recently as last evening when I was talking to someone who noted that, Mr. Evans, the little boy, may have actually been facilitated in his death, that there's some question as to whether or not he would have been provided some sort of drug cocktail that accelerated his death. That story, how was it being reported there in the United Kingdom, first and foremost?
Well, I certainly haven't heard that. I that would be murder.
The question we have a lot of folks who are wondering, how the national health system.
They can believe what they want. And all sorts of conspiracy theories crop up all over the world about all sorts of things. And this is, I think this must be one of them. Okay, the situation here in the UK is the legal situation, and it goes back to a meeting of Harvard scientists in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain that in a moment. The situation is that when the brain stem, which connects the brain to the spinal cord, dies, then that is when the doctors can sign the death certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Not when your heart and lungs stop. The heart and lungs may, in some cases, but not often, but in some cases, may continue. But it is deemed that a person has died when the brain stem has died. Now, this is the case in a lot of American states as well. There are a lot of exceptions. New Jersey, for instance, allows for religious convictions to be taken into account.
Okay, I don't want to get into the weeds on this. Here's the real interesting aspect of this story, though, Tom, and this is one that many of us are still grappling with. As a matter of fact, as recently as this morning, there was an op-ed appearing in the Washington Post on this topic, and that is the fact that the parents were restricted from either removing the child and taking the child to, apparently, Italy had offered support. It's striking that the state took control of the child, and that's
because
got a lot
of... state has responsibility to the child.
Well, no, wait a second. What about the parents?
Well...
I don't think it's fair to debate it, but
okay, we argue here that sometimes the parents do not have the best interest of the child at heart.
But
because they are, if you like, their judgment is clouded by emotion. And I think this would have been one of those cases. I mean, probably if I'd been in their position, I would have done exactly the same thing. It's a very difficult thing to do.
The struggle we're having here in the States, and I would argue, I'm curious about your coverage in other areas other than the United Kingdom. Let me start with this. What has been the response of the United Kingdom, the press there in the United Kingdom, and the general populace? What has been the response to in those two arenas? Good, bad, or indifferent? What?
Well, mixed.
Okay.
Mixed. There's some who support the courts and the medical people, and there's some who support the parents. It's a very divisive issue.
And what about the government?
And within Europe, it's a divisive issue. I think probably you find within the devoutly Catholic countries, such as Italy, that they would, you know, believe in the sacredness of human life, or sanctity of human life.
Right.
And they would try and extend it for as long as possible. And in other countries such as Germany, France, and the Netherlands, they take a much more British, or what I might say, practical view of it. Hmm. And that is, when the brain is dead, the person is dead.
It is striking. And of course, we're talking now about the ultimate conclusion of this. But Alfie was alive and was receiving care up until last week. Again, denial of the ability to take the child to another country, which is really shocking. And the same happened with Charlie Gard. The coverage around the world, is there no sense that the United Kingdom, the British, might be losing some, if you will, social and political capital as a result of this?
I mean, no.
Really?
No, most people around the world support the British position on this. No, that's not true. There are, in the Islamic world, for instance, they do not accept brain death.
I'm talking about the ability of the parents to seek additional medical help, even a second opinion, which I understand was denied. Before the death, before this weekend, was there no concern about the fact that the parents were being denied the opportunity to seek assistance?
There was concern from one part of the population and not from the other. I'm just telling you, it was a very divisive issue. Yes, they did have people demonstrating, actually riots, outside the hospital. Between different factions.
And we've not seen very much of that here in the States.
It's a bit like the pro and anti-abortion lobbies.
No.
I think you find that people who line up on one side of that debate are also the ones lining up the anti-abortion lobbies. Probably a lot of them are lining up behind the pro-Alfie lobby as well.
This also goes to the issue of national health insurance, and I gather that this is part of the role of the national health policy, that they can make these ultimate decisions.
I think you're being too hard on the British here, to be quite honest, it's also, you know, this issue is alive in the States as well, and a lot of insurance. No, don't stop me, Lockwood.
Go ahead.
A lot of the insurance companies are arguing that. In favor of brain death as well, because they don't want to keep coughing up the money.
But wait a second,
you're
Tom.
Absolutely right.
Tom, wait a second.
There is a financial issue. There is an issue of tying up scarce resources.
I appreciate that in relationship to the insurance companies. The difference is, in the case of an insurance company, the family does have recourse. There is a court of higher opinion, a higher authority.
If the family wants to keep paying.
But, in the case of government making that decision, which is, I understand it, is what happened here, there is no recourse. The government has made the decision. It's stunning. And we here in the States, and myself personally, are really shocked by it. But that's to be dealt with later. I do appreciate your observations on this. And of course, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, Look Ahead Radio. We're going to take a quick break and move on to national and international issues here in just a moment with Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. What makes us human? When do we cease to become human? Or to put it another way, when do we die? The questions are becoming increasingly important as cases such as Alfie Evans and Charlie Gard grab the headlines and pull at the world's collective heartstrings. 50 years ago, a group of scientists gathered at Harvard Medical School to discuss the issue. Up until then, it hadn't been an issue. If your heart stopped beating and your lungs stopped breathing, you were dead. But then along came modern science with its ventilators and heart pumps. So the Harvard scientists asked the question, what makes humans unique? What organ of the body differentiates us from other forms of life? And without it, we would cease to exist. The answer they came up with was the brain. On the basis of that meeting, the U.S. Congress passed the 1981 Uniform Death Act, which said doctors could declare a person dead when the brain was deemed to have suffered irreversible and permanent damage. The individual states followed suit, with variations on the theme, of course, as did most Western countries. By 1968, the need for a definition of death had become increasingly necessary. Insurance companies demanded to know how long they would be liable for the medical bills. Doctors wanted to know when they could harvest organs for transplant purposes. The victims' families demanded reassurance that their loved ones would not be declared prematurely dead so that their organs could be harvested. When was a person widowed? When should life insurance be paid? So brain death became the marker for when doctors signed the necessary paperwork. But there were exceptions. Orthodox Jews and Muslims believe that a person does not die until the heart and lungs stop, and argue that doctors' attempts to declare their loved ones brain dead is a denial of their right of freedom of religion. This is recognized by the state of New Jersey, Israel, and the Islamic world, but leads to court cases elsewhere. In Nigeria, doctors work overtime to not declare a person dead because Nigerians believe that they will become an ancestor in the spirit world only if their life is not cut short. There are cases of families paying doctors to delay the signing of the death certificate. Kenyans are more practical. They lack the cash and the resources for respiratory machinery. In a Kenyan hospital, a person dies when their heart and lungs stop working. Using brain death as the criteria for determining patient death also raises the question, when is the brain dead? The British are very specific about this. The brain is dead when the brain stem, which connects the spinal cord to the brain, stops working. But some scientists argue that that is insufficient, because the brain-based gland, the hypothalamus, can continue after the death of the brain stem. Then there's a need for organ donors. It is estimated that in 2016, 7,100 Americans died because of a lack of organ donors. An organ transplant is more likely to be successful if a patient is declared brain dead before their respiratory functions cease. This, of course, again raises the specter of doctors declaring one person prematurely dead in order to save the life of another. In India and Japan, they try to circumvent the problem by requiring organ donor cards to state that they will allow their organs to be removed when they are declared brain dead. Some people argue that neither the brain, heart, or lungs has anything to do with death. Instead, death occurs when a so far undefinable life force leaves the body. New York State is just about the only place where lawyers can argue that option. Finally, there are an increasing number that argue that death should not be decided by doctors, lawyers, judges, or insurance companies. The decision can only be made by the family of the patient. That's a difficult argument to counter when a mother is sitting next to their rosy-cheeked, brain-dead child.
We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of lookaheadnews.com and Look Ahead Radio, joining us from London, England, where it is going on towards midnight this as we air this program, so it has been pre-recorded. Tom, quick question. We talked about this briefly. Israel, Iran, the nuclear agreement. And what role is Israel playing in this? You've mentioned this earlier, we both did, about the discovery of certain documentation associated with Iran's expansion of their nuclear program. What role is Israel playing in this, and what impact does this have with Israel and Europe?
Well, it has a very bad impact on relations between Israel and Europe, because mm-hmm. Israel is obviously playing to Trump's preconceived position. And Trump's preconceived position is that he doesn't want this nuclear accord. Of course, Israel's never wanted it either. So they're in total, absolute agreement. And they are coming up with the facts that fit their preconceived position. Of course, the Europeans are guilty of the same thing by rejecting what Israel is saying, and they are rejecting it. They have their own preconceived position, which is that any deal is better than no deal at all.
Israel has also had recent attacks on Syria. As a matter of fact, I think it was an Iranian training base there in Syria.
Yep.
They've also expressed willingness, if necessary, to go to war with Iran. So there is a dynamic here that while we're talking about the Iranian nuclear program, also plays into the greater concern associated with Iran, possibly Syria, and maybe the influence of Russia. Now we've got Turkey, and by the way, I did see, interestingly enough, that Turkey has noted to the European community they must treat any criticism of Turkish actions in social media as some crime. There's a dynamic here that we probably ought to be paying close attention to in the weeks ahead.
Absolutely. You know, I agree. I mean, you know, you've got a continually moving goalposts all over the Middle East.
Well, of course, you've got, you mentioned,
and no policy, and no American policy, well, no European policy, nothing. There's no strategy. The only countries that have any strategy in this constantly shifting sands at the moment are Iran and Russia.
Wow. Okay. The other player that's not involved, interestingly enough, I don't hear you say anything much about China, but I haven't seen anything to that effect as well. Let's move on.
Well, China's involved in that it's supporting Russia.
Okay.
It's actually giving them some financial support to help pay for their Air Force operations in Syria.
Okay. Let's move on to a real quick note here. Then I want to get into the issue of Theresa May and some issues here that you have shared with me a few moments ago. Proof that Russians interfered in the British elections. How so?
Yeah, Sunday Times produced a big article from their Insight team, that's their investigative reporting team, saying that they have proof now in conjunction with an investigation by Swansea University. Mm-hmm. They have proof that the Russians were actually sending out bots and messages and tweets and everything else during the election campaign in support of Jeremy Corbyn.
So how is that an interference other than, publicity? That's perceived as an interference in the elections process.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's perceived as interference in the election.
Okay. What impact does this have on the current state of the European Union, the Brexit, and the current administration?
Not having much effect on the current state of the Brexit negotiations, it is undermining Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay.
And you've got a situation. I mean, it's a very fluid situation, domestic politics here with Brexit and everything else. You've got several things happening at once, and the Prime Minister is in deep, deep trouble. It would not surprise me if we had to have another general election before the end of the year.
Wow. All right, let's go to that.
There are two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One is Brexit, and the other is something called Windrush, which is our own immigration problem. And Brexit, what's happened there is the Prime Minister has said, we're going to pull out of the customs union, which means that we have the same tariffs and customs duties as the EU.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, she's going to have what's called a customs partnership, which is basically the customs union by another name. And what's happened is that the Brexiteers in the government have told her that unless she supports pulling out of the customs union and not having a customs partnership, they will withdraw from the cabinet. And her government would likely fall.
Her own cabinet
is turning on her.
Really? Now,
yes.
Is it because she's not taking, understanding here, then she's not taking a hard enough line on the issue of Brexit?
That's right.
The whole issue of Brexit has been delayed for a variety of reasons. How much closer are we to the possible exit of Britain, the UK, from the European Union?
The deadline is March next year.
And what has
to? And I don't think we're that much closer. You know, they're making a real dog's dinner of it.
Okay.
But there's another issue at the same time which could bring her down. And that's something called Windrush.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that basically involves rather heavy-handed efforts at deporting people who were here legally. They were legally in this country, and they ended up being deported. In some cases, they were, say, from the West Indies. They went to visit relatives in the West Indies, and they weren't allowed back into the country. And these were legal residents here in the UK, some of them British citizens. And this was a policy that was developed by Theresa May when she was the Home Secretary. And she set targets and everything else for how many people had to be deported and so forth and so on. When she became Prime Minister, that department was taken over by a lady called Amber Rudd. She has been forced to resign because of the policies that were introduced by Theresa May when she was the Home Secretary.
Now,
okay?
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. It gets better because the Labour opposition has demanded and tabled a motion that the Home Office release all the documents from the period of when Theresa May was the Home Secretary. And she has said that she will not allow this to be done.
Wow.
And has called a, what's called a three-line whip to vote against it. And a three-line whip means that if anyone votes other than what the government or what the Prime Minister tells them, they will be kicked out of the party.
She's having as much rebellion within the party as without. Let's talk here about the impact of this on an election. And we've got local elections underway, as which you're engaged in. Is this having any influence, all of this drama?
Yes.
Really?
Labour is doing really well. The Conservatives are doing very, very badly. And of course, local elections are seen as an indicator for how the government would do in a national general election.
And what has been, you know, of course, Theresa May has and the UK have been very skeptical and cynical of the President Trump. I'm wondering, what impact is all this having on the relations with other countries?
Well, it makes it very difficult to have a coherent foreign policy when you're constantly fighting against people in your own party.
I can appreciate that. You're predicting a possible call for an election when?
Oh, before the end of the year, possibly.
Let's move on to one other item before we take our next break. I want to talk about Armenia. What is happening there?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, you've got a country which has very close relations with Russia. And so the president there decided to do a Putin, basically. you know, as you may recall, Putin was first the president of Russia. He did his two terms as president, and then he couldn't do any more. So he became prime minister,
right,
and switched places with his prime minister. And then when that term finished, he went back to being president again. Well, the Armenian president wanted to do the same thing. Unfortunately, it didn't work.
What
the
happened?
People took to the streets and they demonstrated. They occupied government buildings. They had huge demonstrations outside the parliament building and everything else. And so the president had to stand up and say, I was wrong. I should not have done it, which is a complete reversal of, you know, what Putin did. And now they're trying to find a new prime minister, and they're having difficulty in doing it because they've just rejected one, and they're going to have another election on the 8th of May for a new prime minister. So at the moment in Armenia, there is no president, there is no prime minister. There are tens of thousands of people out on the streets demonstrating, and nobody knows what's going to happen.
Interesting. And real quickly, before we wrap it up, is Russia attempting to play any kind of role in this, possibly influencing the outcome?
At the moment, We think not.
Hmm.
At the moment, they seem to be standing back and letting the Armenians deal with it.
Maybe too much.
But the Russians do have a military base in Armenia. And they do have strong economic links. So who knows?
Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, Look Ahead Radio with us here on Viewpoints. Coming up to the close here in just a few moments, we're going to talk briefly about President Trump and the Nobel Peace Prize related to North Korea, but more importantly, the 100th anniversary of a U.S. ship disaster off the Scottish coast. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Joining us this evening, very early in the afternoon for us, but late in the evening for him. So this portion has been pre-recorded. Tom, we were chatting earlier about President Trump and the publicity he's gained, both from national and international issues. The big issue, of course, North Korea, and the proposal that he and Kim Jong-un possibly meet in the demilitarized zone. That's one discussion. But the president of South Korea has suggested that possibly President Trump warrants the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, in light of the fact that President Obama got it shortly after being elected, I'm wondering, how serious is this proposal and what's the Europeans' opinion of it?
Well, it's not just Moon Jae-in who's proposing it. It's also being proposed by the president's friends at Fox.
Oh, well, that's to be expected.
Senator Lindsey Graham.
Yes.
And there's a British bookmaker called Ladbrokes who are giving 2-to-1 odds that Trump will win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Wow. Okay.
And there are people, there's a chap called Ian Bremmer, and he's the head of the Eurasian Group.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he has been very critical of President Trump's foreign policy, but he said the prize should go jointly to Trump, Kim Jong-un, Moon Jae-in, and Xi Jinping.
Well,
so the South and North Korean leaders, the American president, and the Chinese president.
That would be, I don't see anything a problem with that. Many times these prizes are shared. But let's quick question here before we move on to the issue of the 100th anniversary. How is the European media covering this event in North Korea? Are they impressed by this? Is there cynicism, skepticism? And what about the role of President Trump? Is he given any credit?
He's being given some grudging credit.
Okay. All right.
A lot of people say, you know, it's the irony of, you know, to make peace, you seem to have to threaten war.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like that idea. But he has been given some grudging credit. It's very grudging. The skepticism, yes, there is a lot of skepticism.
Right. Okay.
They don't think, they're very skeptical about the success of the Kim-Trump summit.
Well,
they've noted, for instance, that Kim Jong-un has talked not about the denuclearization of North Korea, but the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Right. And I think
that recently President Trump has ruled out the withdrawal of any American troops from South Korea. So those are, you know, seen as major sticking points.
As they are. And I'm pretty confident we're all somewhat skeptical of this. Let's wrap it up then with this 100th anniversary of a U.S. ship disaster off the Scottish coast.
Yeah, I wanted to bring this up because we're coming up to the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One, and this is one of these things which really tugs at the heartstrings, I think. And I think sometimes we have to tug at our heartstrings just to remind us of the links across the Atlantic and so forth. And this weekend, Princess Anne is going to be at an island off the west coast of Scotland called Islay. And in 1918... there were two shipwrecks in the space of a few months, and they were the biggest disasters in American maritime history. One of them involved the American troop ship, the Tuscania, and I think 400 people drowned when that went down. It was sunk by a German U-boat. Another one was a ship called the Otranto, which another several hundred people died when it collided with another ship. And there were 160 people or so. Oh, no, there were 300 people on the island of Islay. And these 300 people rescued as many people as they could. They waded out into the surf in the middle of the winter to do so. They were women, children, trying to rescue people. Of course, they couldn't rescue everyone. Everyone who came ashore that was dead, their bodies were carefully cleaned. All the identifying marks were sent to the War Office in Washington so that families could be told. They were all carefully buried. The women sewed an American flag so that it could be raised over their graves. And I think what's particularly poignant in this is that of the 300 people on the island, 160 people had lost their lives already fighting in World War One.
Right.
And I think that when they buried these American soldiers, you know, they were one thinking of the American soldiers and the sacrifice they were giving, but they were also thinking, that, you know, these people were being buried on their island, which for them was a foreign field.
Right.
But their people had to be buried somewhere else.
In a foreign field. That's a very poignant story. And, of course, we're coming to the conclusion of World War One here in a few months. As a matter of fact, Armistice Day. Tom, as always, do appreciate your time and wish you the very best in your political endeavors. And when do you go on air?
10 o'clock, which would be 5 p.m. your time. And I'll be going... talking until the wee hours of the morning.
Look forward to hearing about this. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio on the political hustings shortly after this program ends. Stay tuned for more here on Viewpoints. As always, Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.